नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं व्यासं ततो जायमुदीरयेत् जायमुदीरयेत् नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवतसेवया भागवतसेवया भगवतीरुत्तमश्लोके उत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्टिकी भक्तिर्भवति नैष्टिकी कृष्णाय वासुदेवाय वासुदेवाय देवकीनन्दनाय च देवकीनन्दनाय च नन्दगोपकुमाराय गोविन्दाय नमो नमः कन्त्रा श्रीमद्भागवतम् Canto 10, Chapter 46, entitled Uddhava Visits Vrindavan, Verse 30. Shri Uddhava Vacha. Yuvam Shlaghyatamau Noonam. Yuvam Shlaghyatamau Noonam. Shlaghyatamau Noonam. देहिनाम इह मानद देहिनाम इह मानद देहिनाम इह मानद नारायणे अखिल गुरौ नारायणे अखिल गुरौ यत्कृता मतिरिदृशी यत्कृता मतिरिदृशी आमतिरिदृशी श्री उद्धव वाच युवां श्लाघ्यतमौ नूनम् श्लाघ्यतमौ मूनम् देहिनामिह मानद देहिनामिह मानद नारायणे अखिल गुरौ अखिल गुरौ यत्कृता मतिरिदृशी मतिरिदृशी श्री उद्धव वाच युवां श्लाघ्यतमौ नूनम् श्लाघ्यतमौ नूनम् देहिनाम् इह मानद इह मानद नारायणे अखिल गुरौ अखिल गुरौ यत्कृता मतिरिदृशी दृशी Matiridrishi. Vaishnavis, Shri Uddhava Vacha. Shri Uddhava said, Yuvam, you too, Shlaghyatamau, the most praiseworthy, Dehinam, of embodied living beings. Iha, in this world, Manada, O respectful one, Narayane, for the Supreme Lord Narayana, Akhila Gurau, the spiritual master of all, Yat, because, Kritaha, produced, Manpatihi, a mentality, Idrishi, like this. Translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Sri Uddhava said, O respectful Nanda, certainly you and Mother Yashoda are the most praiseworthy persons in the entire world. Since you have developed such a loving attitude toward Lord Narayan, the spiritual master of all living beings. Purport. Understanding Nanda's mood, as expressed by his statement, Manye Krishnam cha Ramam cha Prapta viha surottamau. I think Krishna and Ram must be two exalted demigods. Uddhava referred to Krishna as Lord Narayan. Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupah Kadam Maiham Adati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Uta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Pada Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Vishesha Shunyavadi Paschakya Desha Tarine Vancha Kalpataru Bhyascha Kripasindhu Bhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So I seek the blessings of all the devotees so that I can speak something worthwhile on the Srimad Bhagavatam. So today we are discussing about the discussions between Uddhava and Nanda. So now here what has happened is Uddhava has been sent as a messenger by Krishna to Vrindavan. So this incident is one of the most important incidents in the Bhagavatam for illustrating its conclusive message. So the topic I will speak on is today the 9 tensions in the Bhagavatam. So tensions. Oh, what do we see? Every book, every story, every narrative has to have some action for moving forward. And that action is based on some tension. Tension means there are two opposing forces and there is a conflict between them. And now in every substantial book, there is a surface tension and there is a substance tension. So for example, now if you start, look at the Bhagavad Gita. The surface tension is, should Arjuna fight or should Arjuna not fight? Now, that itself can be very interesting. Now for example, there are some movies. So they are filled with action. So the idea is, many people just watch the movie for the action. But if you ask the director or if you ask the author often usually has a deeper message somewhere, something. So for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, the surface tension is whether Arjuna should fight or not fight. And if we just stay at the level of the surface, then it will appear as if the Bhagavad Gita is a message of violence. You know, yes, it is calling upon people to fight and it may seem very contradictory. Why is God causing violence? But that is only the surface. The fundamental conflict or the fundamental tension in the Bhagavad Gita is on what basis should we make our decisions about our actions? Now how should we choose to live? You know, who am I? What is the purpose of my life? And on what basis is this purpose to be decided? So the Bhagavad Gita is not a book of violence or of silence. It is a book of transcendence. You know, in the case of Arjuna, that specific situation was such that Arjuna had to choose to do his duty by fighting. So if we stay only at the level of surface, there can be some entertainment. Okay, this hero was there, this villain was there, and there was a big fight between the two. And then the hero won. Okay, that will just set the level of entertainment. But if we look at what is the substance, okay, this hero now represents a particular way of living. For example, the Ramayana. At a level of action, yes, there is Ram and Ravana, and they have a very exciting fight. But then at a deeper level, what is substance tension? The substance tension is dharma versus adharma. This is very relatively easy to understand, but not always the substance tension is easy to discern. Now, in the Puranas, it becomes even more difficult. Because in the Itihasas and Puranas are both based on historical narratives. But the defining difference between the Itihasa and the Purana is that the Itihas, now the Ramayana and the Mahabharata are the Itihasas. The Puranas are the 18 Puranas, among which the Bhagavatam is the highest. So, the Itihasas focus primarily on one dynasty. Not even on one dynasty, practically one generation of one dynasty. So, the Mahabharata focuses on the Pandavas, one dynasty in the Kuru dynasty. And the Ramayana focuses on Raghuvamsha, and within that also, Lord Ramachandra, Raghuvamsha Pradipaha, as he is called. So, the Itihasas are relatively easier to assimilate for a coherent way. The Puranas have not just one dynasty or one generation, they have many stories from not just different dynasties of different generations, but even from different millennia and even different universes. So understanding the substance theme of the Bhagavatam can be quite difficult. The substance conflict and the substance theme. So now, the Bhagavatam, if we see, I won't go into that subject right now. I talked about earlier. Jiva Goswami in the Shatsandarbhas talks about Tatparya Linga. Tatparya Linga is the five ways by which one can know what is the essential meaning of a book. So basically he concludes that it is pure devotional service to Krishna. That is the conclusion of the Bhagavatam. And this conclusion is developed through various conflicts. So the tensions which are there between in the various incidents are there in the Bhagavatam, they serve a purpose. And that purpose is to illustrate the supremacy of bhakti as compared to everything else. That may be considered important in social material hierarchies or even within spiritual hierarchies. So what are these nine tensions? So these are illustrated through different incidents in the Bhagavatam. So let's first start with the Varna. Normally, a person who is born in a higher Varna, like say a Brahmana, is considered to be superior to a person who is born in a lower Varna. Somebody is born a Shudra or somebody is born a Vaishya, or something like that. So Varna is quite a defining character, significant defining character in the Vedic tradition. And if we look at the Bhagavatam, we will see that the Bhagavatam acknowledges that yes, Varna is important. It gives acknowledgement for that, but then it doesn't give undue importance to that. And that is seen right in the beginning itself. We see Suta Goswami is the speaker. And who is he? He is not exactly a high-born Brahmana. We know that he is born from Pratiloma. So, there's a cross between different Varna. This is often considered to be a contamination. But Suta Goswami is selected as the speaker among a learned assembly of sages. Why? Because what the Bhakti illustrates is, what the Bhagavatam illustrates is, there are, in this world, hierarchies are inevitable. Now, wherever we go, there has to be some hierarchy. You know, even in today, people say democracy. and everybody is equal. But we cannot have a government if everybody is equal. Now somebody has to be the head of the state, somebody has to be the cabinet ministers, somebody has to take up the execution part. So hierarchy has to be there, that's inevitable. The question comes up, on what basis should the hierarchy be decided? So, the Bhagavatam's point is that the ultimate basis for hierarchy is one's disposition of the heart, one's devotion to the Supreme Lord. So, now, prevalent in those times, there were other criteria for hierarchy. And the Bhagavatam acknowledges them, but does not acclaim them as supreme. It acknowledges them and it says that actually bhakti trumps all of them. In fact, bhakti can reverse the normal hierarchies. So, with respect to Varna, we see that here a person whose birth is not ideal, that person is considered to be superior to well-born Brahmanas. So how is that? Because Suta Goswami has great devotion. And this same point, not exactly related to Varna, but similar, is with respect to one's race. Now we could now we see that the devatas are normally considered higher than the asuras. No doubt, devatas are considered good, the asuras are considered to be bad. But in the Bhagavatam, we will see all the Bhagavatam acknowledges this. But then, it also points out that if the asura has bhakti, then the asura becomes far greater than devata. What are the examples of this in the Bhagavatam? Yes, Vritrasur. Then, Vritrasur we see, Vritrasur is a very, in fact there are three instances of this. There can be many more, but three prominent. Vritrasur is one, Prahlad is Prahlad Maharaj is second, and then Bali Maharaj. Now each of them is in their own way unique. Now Vritrasur, the difference between Vritrasur and Bali on one side and Prahlad on the other side is that Prahlad never acts in a demoniac way. Right from the birth itself, he says, Naishtiki Bhagavatamati. He's constantly devoted to the Lord. But with respect to Vritrasur and Bali Maharaj, you know, it is, the Bhagavatam goes in such a way that they are acting as if they are demons. In fact, Vritrasur fights against the Devatas, attacks the Devatas. Bali Maharaj attacks the Devatas. Actually, the Bali Maharaj pastime starts from the 5th chapter of the 8th canto. And till the 10th chapter, there's no indication of any devotional characteristic in Bali Maharaj. In the 11th chapter, the first hint comes when Bali Maharaj, when Indra is saying, now I am going to kill you. So Bali Maharaj at that time speaks philosophy and he says, ultimately victory and defeat are determined by the will of the Supreme Lord. So those who have won today may be defeated tomorrow and those who are defeated today may win tomorrow. Don't be so proud of winning. But that's all. Then again after that, he is killed and he is revived by Shukracharya. And then actually only the 20th chapter, when he surrenders everything. When Vamandev appears, he surrenders everything. That time his devotion becomes manifest. Same way with Dhritarasur, is fighting and killing and destroying the devatas. And suddenly, you know, he starts making profound prayers. So what does this indicate? So actually, of course, for each of these pastimes, the acharyas give explanations. Why at particular times these asuras or these individuals, they are not exactly asuras, they are asura bodies, why they suddenly start manifesting that devotion. But the point is, as Vishwanath Chakra Thakur explains in his Raghavatma Chandrika, that actually bhakti is not necessarily manifest right from the time the body is manifest. We say that bhakti is never lost. Now, if we are not able to complete our bhakti in this life, in the next life it will go on. But it will go on, but it is not that right from birth, when the baby is born, the baby will be born with a bead bag in hands or tilak on the forehead. Nothing like that happens. The baby is born normally and it may not appear also as if the child is having any devotion. But by the arrangement of the Lord, when the right time comes, then Purvabhyasena te naiva riyate yava shopisaha. So, riyate yava shopisaha. Helplessly one's hearts get attracted to Krishna. So, when that will happen, we can't say. But the point is, once that happens, what the Bhagavatam demonstrates is that Indra is considered the best of the gods. And the Mahabharata depicts Indra in a very respectful way. In fact, for Arjuna, it's considered to be a great honor that Indra invites him to heaven in his own chariot, and then Prapta Mahendra Bhavane Mahadasanardham, he gets to sit in the same throne as Indra. Indra invites him as a son and he sits on half of the throne. It's a great honor. But when compared with bhakti, so what happens is Indra is trumped by Vritrasura, and similarly he is trumped by Bali Maharaj. So here what we see is, so it, within the Varna itself, now which Varna do the Devatas and Asuras belong to? I kept it as slightly separate because both actually belong, if you look at the Varnashram point of, they belong to the Kshatriya Varna. Sometimes some people say Ravana's father was a Pulastya Rishi, was a Brahmana, so Ravana was a Brahmana. That's not a very valid logic, because actually if we go back dynastically, you know, everybody's father is a Brahmana, isn't it? All of us have come from Brahmaji, who is a Brahmana, and all of us have come from the Shapta Rishi, the seven Gotras are there. They are also, the founders are Brahmanas. But then we have to look at the qualities. So among the Devatas, Brahmaji is considered to be a Brahmana. It's interesting that although the name Brahmastra is there, Brahmastra is not the Astra of Brahma. Brahmastra refers, that the Brahma refers to the power of the Supreme Brahman, of the spiritual reality. Brahmaji practically never fights. Brahmaji is the advisor to the fighters. He is not a fighter. So Brahmaji is a Brahmana, but Devatas, Indra, Chandra, Vayu, Surya, Agni, Kuvera, they are all Kshatriyas. Similarly, the Asuras, the Rakshasas are also Kshatriyas. Ravana, if you read in the Mahabharata, he is a king and he patronizes Brahmanas. Of course, not the Brahmanas who are Sattvic. He patronizes Brahmanas who are Tamasic. They are called Yatudhanas. And they do rites for invoking auspiciousness for him. So the point is that the Bhagavatam demonstrates a person may be a Devata also. But if somebody has devotion, then what happens is the person with devotion, even if that person is demoniac, is far greater than a person with who is divine in the sense of being a Devata, but not having devotional qualities so much. Now, along with race, there is also, when we come to Varna, there is gender. Now, normally, the females are considered to be low-born. Even Krishna seems to support that when he says in 9.32-33 that Ye pisyo papayonayaha striyo vaishyastha shudras te piyanti paramgatim. He says that among the low-born, papayonayaha, he says there are striya, vaishya and shudra. The women, the vaishyas and the shudras. So now it's interesting, now what does this statement imply? Is this a statement that supports gender discrimination against women? Is this a sexist put down of women? Actually not at all. What the Bhagavad Gita is stating is, at that time, in that social convention, women were considered low-born. But what is Krishna's emphasis when he's talking about this? Māmhipārtha vyāpāśrityā yepi syupāpayonaya striyo vaishyātata shudras te piyanti parāmgatim. So Krishna is saying, even if somebody is considered low-born, it doesn't matter. Yes, so it's like, there is a saying, do in Rome as Romans do. So Krishna acknowledges nominally the truth. Yes, women are considered low-born, but that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The path of bhakti is so wonderful, so wonderfully speedy, so wonderfully potent, that once we start off, the starting point doesn't matter. Once we start off, the starting point doesn't matter. It is a simple fact that all of us are of different natures. So now, the nature that we have is our starting point. So, it's simply utopian to imagine that all of us are identical, because we are not. Different people have different intellectual capacities, different people have different physical capacities, different people have different levels of social intelligence. It's different. So, the starting points which all of us get are different. But these starting points don't matter once we start off, because bhakti takes us up so fast that it doesn't matter. So the what the Bhagavad Gita says that anybody can attain perfection. The Bhagavatam demonstrates in its 23rd chapter of the 10th canto. There we see the conflict between the genders, the Brahmanas, Yagic Brahmanas and their wives. The Yagic Brahmanas, the husband is considered within the Vedic tradition to be the guru of the wife. And the wife should always follow the husband. But what does the Bhagavatam illustrate? That actually if the wife has devotion, now if we see in this case, the contrast is very striking, because the husbands of these Yagic Brahman Patnis, they are in no way demoniac. They are pious, they are religious, they are virtuous. But in spite of all that, the Bhagavatam demonstrates that even if one may be Satvaguna, even if we are doing Brahmanical duties, but if one does not practice bhakti, then one is considered to be unfortunate. And the Brahmanas themselves acknowledge that. Diktam, diktam, they say. Oh, how unfortunate are we that we did not realize the glory of the opportunity that we had to serve Lord Krishna. Now what happens with those Brahmanas? Then when they initially, when the wives were going, they were opposing them. And later when the wives come back, they welcome them. So our acharyas explained that in the intermediate, when they did the yajna, that the devatas came. They accept the sacrifices. But the devatas told them. He says, you have done the sacrifice, but Yajneshwar, he had come to ask you for some offerings and you refused him. What is the use of your yajna? So then from their perspective, they had to understand it. And then they learned the lesson. So we discuss about Varana, we discuss about race in terms of demigods and demons. Then we discuss about gender. Then the Bhagavatam also talks about ashram. Ashram in terms of position, Varana ashram. So normally a sannyasi is considered to be far higher than a grihastha. But we see in the 9th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a tension between Durvasa Muni and Parikshit Maharaj. And actually this tension is even both from Varana and ashrama point of view. Now Parikshit Maharaj is a grihastha and a kshatriya. Durvasa Muni is a brahmana and a sannyasi. But what happens? It's like Durvasa Muni initially, now see, it illustrates such a big difference. That a kshatriya is supposed to raise weapons and a brahmana is not supposed to raise weapons, no matter what the provocation. But what the Bhagavatam illustrates is when the kshatriya has devotion, the natural disposition that might be there to raise weapons whenever one is challenged, Durvasa Muni, Ambarish Maharaj does not do that. He as a kshatriya, he could have used weapons, and as a Vaishnava, he could have invoked the power of the Lord to counter the curse, to counter that demon who was attacking him, and to counter curse Durvasa, but he did neither. But eventually what happened? Durvasa Muni was overpowered by the power of the Supreme Lord. So what the Bhagavatam is illustrating over here is, that as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, that Naham Viprona Chandarpatir Napi Vaishyona Shudru Naham Varani Grahapatir Vanastho Yatirava. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we see that he says that I am not belonging to any Varana, I am not belonging to any ashrama. I am simply the servant of the Lord. Kintu Prodhyan Nikhila Paramananda Purana Amritabde Gopi Bharto Padakamalayor Dasa Dasa Anudasaha. But I am the servant of the servant of the gopis. Servant of the servant of the Lord of the gopis. So now it's interesting, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejects that I am not a sannyasi, but we see in his life, he acts as a strict sannyasi. Why is that? When he is saying, I am not a sannyasi, what does it mean? He says that he doesn't reject the existing social order, but he doesn't let himself be absorbed in it. That social order is there, he accepts that. But he doesn't let that sort of put him in a tunnel vision. Recognize, that's why he goes to Ramananda Rai and he wants to demonstrate to the world. It's very interesting, when Ramananda Rai and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu meet, Ramananda Rai acts as the, in one sense, the teacher of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asks questions and Ramananda Rai answers. But still, when they look at it, what is it? It is Ramananda Rai who offers obeisances to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu doesn't offer obeisances to Ramananda Rai. Why is that? Because from the social point of view, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is sannyasi, Ramananda Rai is a grahastha. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is a brahmana, Ramananda Rai is a shudra. So the social order is respected. But the respect for the social order does not become restrictive. If somebody has devotion, that devotion is acknowledged. And by the devotional qualification, that person is given the necessary recognition. So this is with respect to ashrama. Then we can also look at another parameter by which people recognize who is great and who is small, is with respect to wealth and social position. So now normally a king is considered to be a very glorious person. But we see in the fifth canto that we have this confrontation between Maharaj Rahuguna and Bharat Maharaj. Now he's become Jad Bharat in this life. So now in one sense, from the material point of view, leave alone the Varanashram structure, any society, you know, people would like to have opulence like a king. And who would like to be a person whom whose existence no one knows about? That's what Jada Bharat was. Just living in the forest, nobody knew about him. So one was a person like whom everybody would like to be, that is Maharaj Rahuguna. And the other is a person like whom nobody would like to be. And yet what the Bhagavatam illustrates is that in the world's eye, Rahuguna might be very great and Jada Bharat might be very small. Insignificant. But from the point of view of Shastra Chakshu, it is Jada Bharat who becomes the instructor of Maharaj Rahuguna. So even from the wealth point of view, so whatever are the parameters by which in this world somebody may be considered great, the Bhagavatam acknowledges that, but then it transcends them. Now these are with respect to the social positions in this world, or the markers of social designations. But now the next four are with respect to conceptions of the Absolute Truth. Conceptions of the Absolute Truth. The Bhagavatam begins, 1.1.1 begins with Dhimahi. It says meditate on the Absolute Truth. But then, actually these three verses itself, they are so significant. Then after that, it says, second verse is Dharma Projahita. Give up all the lower dharmas. And then it says Pibata Bhagavata Rasamalaya Muhuraho Rasika Bhuvibhavukaha. So Dhimahi, meditation is done normally when there is a conception of the Absolute Truth in terms of greatness, vastness. So often the Dhimahi, it's a part of the Gayatri. When people do mantra meditation on the Gayatri, often they are not even aware whom they are meditating on. Surya Narayan. It's the all-pervading power of the Absolute Brahman. So normally the Dhimahi, that meditation is frequently associated with the impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth. But rasika bhavokaha, drinking of rasa, that can be only with the personal conception. So, now we are talking about different conceptions. Often people think that, oh, bhakti is for less intelligent people and the impersonal conception, that is the real conception. But what the Bhagavatam illustrates is, through the example of Shukdev Goswami, illustrates that, how a person who is at the impersonal conception, rises to the personal conception. So in one sense, the Bhagavatam is like a intellectual autobiography of Shukadev Goswami. Intellectual autobiography means what? Not a narrative autobiography where he describes this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. No, intellectual autobiography means there are some people, now these intellectual autobiographies are not as relishable or enjoyable as a narrative autobiographies. Because narrative autobiography, like say his Radhanath Maharaj journey home is there. Now that can be made, if it is made into a movie, it can become an action movie. But if you have an intellectual biography, then if that is made into visual form, that won't become a movie. That will become a documentary. So, because it is full of analysis. So there are several authors. So there are some Christian thinkers who have written their own biographies. Okay, they read, okay, in my life, you know, these are the books that were my formative influences. And I read this book, and what are the influence of reading this book? I read this book, and what are the influence of reading this book? I read this book. And then through the journey of studying various books, then they may write, okay, how I read this book, and then that inspired me to give my life to Jesus, or whatever like that. So there can be intellectual biographies, or autobiographies. where one describes one's own intellectual and spiritual evolution more in intellectual terms. So, what the Bhagavatam is doing is, how Shukadeva Goswami rose from the impersonal conception to the personal conception, that is what the Bhagavatam is progressively illustrating. So it begins, actually speaking, the Bhagavatam begins not just from the first canto or even from the second canto. The Bhagavatam's thematic instruction actually begins from the Virata Rupa that comes in the last part of the second canto. So before that, there's just a condemnation of material life. Then there is the description of the various incarnations. So there, that idea is, when he's talking about the Virata Rupa, the Virata Rupa is primarily a tool. Just as the Virata Rupa is everywhere, similarly Brahman is everywhere. So that is a tool for meditating on the absolute truth as the Brahman eventually. So basically, what the Bhagavatam illustrates is how somebody's impersonal conception moves towards the personal conception. And this is also, of course, illustrated in the Four Kumaras example in the third canto. Now, moving forward, we come to the theme over here. Here we see that after talking about personal and impersonal conception, then there is the conception of the absolute truth in Aishwarya and in Madhurya. So of course, between that there is another conception which is not very detailed talked about. That is the conception between Vishnu and Krishna. So the Bhagavatam does not dwell too much on that, but it does point it out very clearly, especially towards the end of the 10th canto, when even it is described how Mahavishnu wanted to have the darshan of Krishna. And for that, what happened? He took away the children of the Brahmana, and Arjuna and Krishna came over there. So there is a conflict between which is the highest conception of the absolute truth. It is not just the personal over the impersonal, but it is the conception of Krishna over the conception of Vishnu. So now what I am going to talk about is from the personal to the specifically Krishna versus Vishnu, and then we'll have Vraja Krishna versus Dwarka Krishna. So this is the trajectory which is talked about by Sanatan Goswami in Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So now, you know, he calls it the Bhagavatamrita. But if you just look at the story linearly, you say, what has this got to do with Bhagavatam? There is some Gopakumara who is going here and going there. The Bhagavatam has so many themes, but what is the relationship between Bhagavatamrit and Bhagavat? So actually, what is the Amrit of the Bhagavata? The Amrit of the Bhagavata is the progressively sweeter understanding of the absolute truth. So how one progresses towards more and more sweet understanding of the absolute truth? The Brihad Bhagavatamrita has two parts. First part is, who is the highest devotee? And the second part is, who is the highest form of the, who is the highest Bhagavan? And that is what is illustrated in this Bhagavatam. Ultimately, the highest devotees are the gopis, and the highest conception of the absolute truth is Krishna, Vraja Krishna. So now that is actually, our acharyas are focused on that alone. Now before Vishwanath Chakra Thakur was the person who commented on the full Bhagavatam, and he wrote his Bhavartha Saratha Darshini. Now before that, in our tradition, the only person who commented fully on the Bhagavatam was Srinath Chakravarti. He wrote a commentary called Chaitanya Manjusha. But on all the Bhagavatam was considered the most important book, but none of the Goswamis commented on the full Bhagavatam. Now Sanatana Goswami wrote Vaishnava Toshani, and Jiva Goswami also wrote a commentary on the Bhagavatam. And now he has Shatsandarbhas, which are more like a thematic compilation of the Bhagavatam. But he also wrote a Kramasandarbha, which is like a selective commentary on important verses, annotations on the important verses. This is Madhvacharya did not write any commentary on the Bhagavad Gita directly. He just gave comments on some important verses. And so if you get a commentary on the Bhagavatam, it's not Bhagavad Gita of Madhvacharya. He said, there's no comment on this verse, no comment on this verse, no comment on this verse. Because he did not write a commentary per se. It is, and other various places he has commented on the Bhagavad Gita, that has been compiled and made into a commentary. So Kramasandarbha is like that. But both these acharyas, Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami, did comment on the 10th canto. And very beautiful commentaries. Very, very beautiful commentaries. Jiva Goswami actually commented twice. Now, he took Vaishnava Toshani of Sanatana Goswami and elaborated that verse by verse by verse. And then he also wrote Gopal Champu, which is not just a commentary on the 10th canto, it is like a retelling of the 10th canto, where he doesn't go specifically verse by verse on the 10th canto, he just narrates the story in very beautiful poetic Sanskrit. The word Champu refers to a particular literary composition. You know, generally there's Gadya and there's Padya, there is prose and there is poetry. So in certain literary compositions, when prose and poetry are both combined together according to very specific and precise rules, that is called as a champu. So champu is not something which is very easy to write. One has to not only have knowledge of the subject, one also has to have knowledge of language, of grammar, one has to have linguistic mastery to be able to write that. So again, the point which I am making here is that this is the essence of the Bhagavatam, the progressive revelation of the highest conception of the Absolute Truth. So there is Krishna versus Vishnu, which comes in the last 2-3 chapters of the 10th canto. And then within Krishna also, there is Krishna in Aishwarya Bhav and Krishna in Madhurya Bhav. And Uddhava, why we are discussing all this is, now we are coming to Uddhava here. So Uddhava is at the crux of, is at the junction point of this tension. That Uddhava, actually if you see, Vrindavan, if you consider as one circle, and Dwarka and Mathura as another circle, there are actually only three people who are in both places, along with Krishna. First is of course Balram. You know, he is in Vrindavan, and then he comes with him to Mathura and then to Dwarka. The second is Devaki. Devaki is there because it's described that Kamsa, his primary target was Devaki and Vasudev. But then he was apprehensive that these devatas are so cunning that who knows, they are saying the Ashtam Garbha of Devaki, but who knows, from some other wife of him also the Garbha, my nemesis may come. Death makeup. So he eventually started persecuting others also. So that's why initially Rohini was with Vasudev in Mathura only. But then he told her to secretly depart. And normally at that time when queens would travel, what to speak of traveling alone, they would travel in a palanquin with chariot and many guards. But Vasudev told Rohini should go all alone on a single horse. And she went very discreetly. And he had sent before a discreet message to Ananda that Rohini will be coming. That's how she came to Vrindavan. When Krishna went with his father to Mathura, and then the Mathura was said, Krishna should stay here for some time, at least. And Krishna said, I'll come back. But then what happened is, at one level Krishna is God, but in his rasa he doesn't act as God. So now if you see, how old was Krishna when he went from Vrindavan to Dwarka? Yeah, it was very small, 10 or 11 years old, isn't it? Not to Dwarka, to Mathura. So he was very, very young. So now, what he found, Vasudev saw that Krishna, he couldn't relate with anybody in Dwarka, in Mathura. You know, he had since his childhood called Yashodamai his mother, and suddenly, you know, you are a 10-year-old boy and you take him and tell some other ladies your mother. It's very difficult. So now Vasudev did not have the heart. That was just out of question to send Krishna back to Vrindavan. And what to do? Then he decided that, let me call Devaki. Krishna has been very affectionate with Devaki. She has been there right through his childhood. So then he called him back. And now Devaki and Rohini had become so close to each other. And Rohini said that, Rohini. Not Devaki, Rohini. So Rohini was the person who had gone to Vrindavan. And Krishna could not yet refer to Devaki as a mother, because she was completely new to him. So he said that at least as a via media, let us have Rohini come back. So then Rohini said to Yashoda, he says, you know, we two have always been together. You know, how can I leave you? So now what was unspoken was wife's places with her husband. She has to go. Then at that time Yashoda said, you know, if you can touch, if you can embrace Krishna, if you can have Krishna sitting on your lap, you can offer your love to Krishna. Then through that, even my separation from Krishna will be mitigated, because we two are one. Please go. And then Krishna made, and Yashoda Mai made many gifts for Krishna, many eatables, clothes and other things. And then Rohini went from there. So now when Rohini came there to Dwarka, to Mathura and eventually Dwarka, she was the second person. And the third person who had some kind of intersection was Uddhava. Now Uddhava, actually his entry into the Bhagavatam is just mentioned first in the third canto, where there is a whole chapter of his remembrance of Krishna. But in the tenth canto, Uddhava enters directly, more or less this chapter. So it's described in Gopal Champu that after Krishna kills Kamsa, and then he comes out of the assembly where the fighting was going on, then he looks around, he goes and offers respect to his parents, but he's not able to relate with anyone, nor is anyone else able to relate with him very closely. Why? Because for him all of these are elders and strangers, and for all of them, you know, they know he's killed Kamsa, he's Narayan himself, he's in our dynasty, but he's Narayan himself, so they're also very respectful to him. So Krishna wants a friend, and then he sees Uddhava sitting there in behind him, and he says, oh Uddhava, my friend, and he runs and embraces him, and Uddhava is delighted to see Krishna. Now Krishna has heard about Uddhava from Narad Muni before. Narad Muni is a messenger who keeps people, informing people about everyone. So when has he informed him? We know that just before Krishna left Vrindavan, Narad Muni comes to Vrindavan and tells him what all he is going to do in the future. You know, he tells, okay, then you are going to do this and you are going to do this. At that time he tells about how your family is there and Uddhava is also there. So Krishna is delighted to meet Uddhava, and then from that time their closeness becomes very, very intimate. So at one level we can say they are eternal associates. That is true. But the way they meet and their relationship develops is also very sweet. Just like Krishna and Arjuna, they are eternal associates. But then when do they meet for the first time? You know, when Draupadi Swayamvar happens, and after that Krishna and Pandavas go back to the hut where they are living. There Krishna and Balaram follow them. And then when they come to the palace, when they come to that small hut, then Krishna introduces himself. This is Balaram and I am Krishna. And then that is the first time when Arjuna and Krishna meet each other. So like that, it is the first meeting between Uddhava and Krishna also. So now Uddhava is at the vortex. Vortex is like the central activating point, at the vortex of this tension between the Aishwarya conception of Krishna and the Madhurya conception of Krishna. So in his Brahma Samhita commentary, Jiva Goswami explains that around Vraja Krishna there is Vaikuntha Krishna. Around Vrindavan there is what he calls as Vaikuntha Vrindavan. He says that those people who worship Krishna in the mood of Vishnu, thinking him to be an incarnation of Vishnu, that's not wrong. There are many people in India who consider that Krishna is one of the incarnations of Vishnu. And there are verses in Vishnu Puran which can be used to substantiate that idea. And we don't have to make a campaign against this idea. That's accepted. So Jiva Goswami does go about it elaborately in Krishna Sandarbha. And he establishes, giving so many verses, how Krishna is the highest manifestation of the Absolute Truth. And he also establishes how Krishna is the source of all the avatars. But those who do not accept this, they are not wrong. He says that around there is Vaikuntha Vrindavan. And Vaikuntha Vrindavan, around Vrindavan, there those who worship Krishna as a manifestation of Vishnu, they attain there. They attain that destination. And if their attraction is to Krishna, then they will go to Krishna. Because they are thinking of him in Vishnu form, then they will attain that destination. They will attain him in Vishnu form. So there Krishna doesn't manifest the higher rasas so much. Krishna manifests formally the formal relationship, Dasya and Shanta, and very little, as we see in Lord Ramchandra Sakya or Vatsalya or Madhurya. Not so much. So anyway, so Uddhava is at this, he is from Dwarka, Dwarka Mathura. And there, Krishna is primarily worshipped in Aishwarya. And there is Vrindavan where Krishna is worshipped in Madhurya. So now when Uddhava goes from Mathura Dwarka to Vrindavan, so what are his thoughts? Krishna tells Uddhava that, you know, tell my family members, that tell the Vrajavasis that I will soon come back. So I have to kill a few demons, and then he gives a message. Now of course, the message which they are given is going to come in the next chapter. Right now, in this 46th chapter, Uddhava is going to speak to the parents of Krishna. In the next chapter, he speaks to the gopis. Actually, Jiva Goswami as well as Chakravarti Pada give a very beautiful analysis of the message of Krishna. Because at one level, Krishna's message appears to be very, very dry and arasic. You know, he says, there's no separation from me is possible because I am all pervading. Now, actually, Jiva Goswami gives a very beautiful analysis that every verse that Krishna is saying, what is its outer meaning and what its inner meaning. So the gopis, first they hear the outer meaning, they feel, we're not interested in this. But then they meditate on it, this is the meaning of Krishna. And then they give a response, they're thinking something. And immediately, so Krishna is confident that the gopis will understand the inner meaning that he is giving. And for the world, he also gives the outer meaning. So, why the outer meaning and the inner meaning, I can't go into that right now. But the point is, that the outer meaning is for those who are in this world, and who have yet to develop affection for Krishna. For them, how they can live so that they can gradually develop affection for him. That is what he's talking about. But for those who have already developed affection, then Krishna's message is to encourage them to continue on so that they can eventually experience, relish even greater intimacy with him. So at one level, this conflict is between the Aishwarya Bhav and the Madhurya Bhav. And what happens? Uddhava goes out initially to instruct. But when he goes out to instruct, Vrajavasis, he says, don't worry. You know, Krishna is everywhere. Krishna is the Supreme Lord. And you have attained perfection of your life, as he will say now. But eventually he realizes, the mood is that when we go, you have already attained success. So what does that mean? It can be said in various ways. It depends on who is saying it. If a teacher tells a student, you already attained success, that means it's implied over there that the teacher is already at an elevated position, and teacher is telling the student, you have also attained success. You are also a very great person. Now, if there are two equals who say you have attained success, then what it means is that the equal has attained something very high. And if a subordinate says to a superior, you have attained success, now what does that mean? The conception of success will be dependent on what is the hierarchy? So the success is always a success. But it's different at different levels. Because the person who is offering the felicitation, the congratulation, what is the conception of that person is important. So initially Uddhava is thinking, this from the perspective of Mathura and Vrindavan, is thinking that he is learned, he has been taught by Brihaspati, he has practiced bhakti since his childhood. And the Vrajavasis are, they are almost like illiterate, they are cowherd men. And he is felicitating them. Oh yes, you have also done something. You have attained such great devotion. But he is simply going to say, you have some attraction for Krishna. But remember that Krishna is always there. Don't worry, don't be separated from him. But then as he meets with them, as he interacts with them, then he realizes that actually, who am I to offer them any instruction, any guidance? Actually, they are far greater than me. They are far, far greater than me. And I am no one in front of them. In the Mahabharata also, at the end of the Virata Parva, towards the end of the Pandava stay in Virat. Now, initially Bhuminjaya, who is the son of Virat, he is very proud and arrogant. And he says, I will single-handedly go and defeat the Kaurava army. I just need a charioteer. And then, and he says, just as Arjuna defeated the Devas at Khandava, I will defeat all the warriors who have assembled over there. I just need a charioteer. So then, Draupadi is infuriated to hear this arrogant prince comparing himself with Arjuna. But then Arjuna hears this is a good opportunity. So he tells Draupadi, who is Shairindri over there, he says, you go and tell him that Brihanalla had acted as a charioteer earlier. So he can act as your charioteer also. So now Bhuminjaya is initially so proud, he says, you know, but how can I ask a eunuch to be my charioteer? He thinks that what to speak of eunuch becoming my charioteer, even asking a eunuch will be demeaning for me. So then, now, Draupadi, when she hears Arjuna being demeaned like this, her heart blazes with anger. But then she keeps herself restrained and then she says, you tell your sister Uttara, she will ask him. So he says, okay, Uttara ask. And then Brihanalla comes and he goes with him in chariot. And then what happens? Now Bhuminjaya initially is very proud, strutting like a proud peacock. But then when he sees the Kaurava army, it's endless, and he sees warriors. He says to Brihanalla, he says, you know, initially I said I will give you a prize if you become my charioteer. Now I said I'll give you a prize if you take me away from here. He says, you should fight. He says, no, I cannot fight. And then what does Krishna say, Arjuna say? Okay, if you cannot fight, he says, you become the charioteer, I'll become the warrior. He says, you becoming the warrior? How is that possible? Then he tells that, I am Arjuna. And then he gives the eight names of Arjuna, Bibhatsu, Savyasachi and all of them. Then he accepts. And then eventually, when Arjuna gets his conch shell from the Shamik tree, and then he blows his conch shell. The blow is so thunderous, that practically Bhuminjaya falls down from the charioteer's position, just hearing the sound. So what happens? Initially Bhuminjaya is very proud, thinking I am a great warrior, and then eventually realizes I am no one in front of Arjuna. So not exactly same, but something similar. Uddhava is initially thinking I am going to instruct the Vrajavasis, but by the time he leaves Vrindavan, what is his prayer? His prayer is that let me just become one shrub, one bramble, one piece of grass in Vrindavan, so that the Vrajavasis will put their foot on me and I'll be blessed by their food dust. So here, this is how I have compared to the Aishwarya Bhakti, the Madhurya Bhakti is glorified. And of course, the highest tension in the Bhagavatam, this will be the concluding part, that is illustrated in the 31st chapter of the 10th canto. And that is the whole mood of the Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that is Sanyoga and Viyoga, that is union and separation. So the gopis, when Krishna calls them in the 29th chapter by playing his flute, the gopis rush everything. Sarva dharman parityajamame kam sharanam raja. They rush, leave everything and come to Krishna. And in the 30th chapter they have some talk, and by the end of it Krishna disappears. And in the 31st chapter the gopis call out to Krishna fervently, desperately, begging him, please come back, please appear. And then 32nd chapter, Krishna appears and there he has discussion. And there is the famous verse, Naparayeham. Krishna says that I cannot repay you. I cannot repay you. This sentiment, I cannot repay you, is not found anywhere else in the Bhagavatam so explicitly. In the 9th canto, when Lord Narayan is speaking to Durvasa Muni, he says, how can I give up my devotees who have given up everything for me? So he says, yes, I will never give up my devotees. But the idea that I cannot repay my devotees, this only Krishna expresses, and he expresses that for the gopis. So the Bhagavatam, so now Krishna tells that why did I go away from you? Not because I was hard-hearted, not because I didn't care for you, but because I wanted you to experience the highest rasa of remembrance. The highest rasa of remembrance that happens in separation. So how does this happen? Actually, when there is a fire and then there is a wind, Krishna talks in the 6th chapter, 19-20th verses that, you know, yatha dipo nivatastho neengate sopamasmatah. He says, normally, if there is a flame, there is a candle. And for the candle to blow steadily, there should not be any wind. So Krishna compares over there, the winds are the material desires. And the flame is like our spiritual consciousness. So when there are no material desires, then our consciousness can stay fixed in Krishna. We see that in chanting also. Now, if there are material desires, then we just can't concentrate on Krishna. So, the idea is there should not be any wind for the flame of our spiritual consciousness to stay steady. If there is too strong a wind, then the flame will get extinguished also. Otherwise, it will be shaky. But, imagine if... So, now, why do material desires come up? Because there are thoughts of material sense objects close by. So, if there are thoughts of Krishna close by, then that wind will not be there at all, material desires. So, now, just as if there is a small flame, and then there is a wind, the fire, a small fire is extinguished by the wind. But a big fire is expanded by the wind. You know, if there is a house on fire, and a big wind comes, and the fire will go to the next house and set that also on fire. So, like that, in the initial stages of our bhakti, you know, if we decide that, oh, love and separation is very good, so I will stay separated from devotees. I will not go to temple, I will not associate with devotees. So our bhakti is like a small flame. And what will the wind of separation do? So it will extinguish that flame. It will extinguish that flame. But when the flame of devotion is so strong, so it's like a huge fire, like a conflagration, then when the wind comes, the wind causes that fire to spread more and more. Similarly, when there is viraha, when there is separation, there is greater intensification of the remembrance. Actually, two things happen. I'll conclude with this example. The acharyas describe that when an elephant is growing up, so the elephant does not know how strong it is. But if it is found that the elephant is... Now the elephant is very thirsty and wants to go to the water, and nobody is providing water, and the elephant is tied. Then what happens? The elephant pulls against the tree. And then with all its strength, when it pulls, then the tree itself may fall. And initially the elephant would not even have thought that I'll be able to break this tree. But because the thirst is so great, so what happens is the tree starts falling. And then two things are happening. There is internal realization and there is external expression of the strength of the elephant. The elephant itself may not have realized earlier that I have so much strength that I can cause this tree to fall. And onlookers may not also thought that, okay, this is just a baby elephant growing up. How can it break a tree? But it breaks the tree. So like that, when for a devotee there is separation from Krishna, for an advanced devotee, then in that separation, there is internal realization and external expression of the devotion. So, when Krishna separates himself from the gopis, he demonstrates to the gopis and to the world how great is their devotion. So, this is the conclusive message of the Bhagavatam, that love and separation is the highest love. And actually that is what is ultimately possible for us in the material world. At an external level, it appears as the Bhagavatam ends in a tragic note. Now, Krishna dies to the external vision. There's a whole tragedy which wipes out the Yaduvamsa. And then at the end of it all, Parikshit also dies. And at the end of it all, there is Kali Yuga also coming. So what happened after hearing the Bhagavatam? You know, there's a tragic destruction of Krishna's dynasty. There's a heartbreaking departure of Krishna. There is the still the inevitable death of the person who is hearing Bhagavatam. And there is still the inevitable coming of Kali Yuga. So you may say everything failed, nothing happened successfully. But what is successful is that through the remembrance coming from sound, even when there is separation, there can be union. There can be union through sound vibration. And that is the essential message of the Bhagavatam. The gopis, when they are separated from Krishna, what do? They sing the Gopi Gita. And that's how they remember Krishna. And the ultimate conflict, the tension that is there in the Bhagavatam is union with Krishna better or is separation from Krishna better? So what Bhagavatam illustrates is, not that union is bad, But that even in separation, not only can be their remembrance, but there can be greater remembrance than what is possible. And this is the distinctive contribution of the Srimad Bhagavatam, of how one can have intense devotion for Krishna in his absence. And that is what Uddhava will realize also. Now, Uddhava has gone to the Vrajavasis to console Krishna in the separation from him, but then he will realize that actually in separation from Krishna, the gopis are remembering him and they are at a greater state of Krishna consciousness than what he can ever be. So I'll summarize. Started by talking about how to understand the essential message of any book, we have to look at its tensions, not just surface tension, but also at the substance tension. And then we discussed about Ramayana and Mahabharata, how what are their surface tensions and what are the substance tensions. The Bhagavad Gita is not a book about violence, it is a book about transcendence. Then we discuss about the 9 levels of tensions in the Bhagavatam. First we discuss based on Varana, and within Varana itself we can say, or connected with Varana, we talk about birth, where race, where is Devas and Asuras, and we also talk about gender, how the females, the Yajna Brahmana Patnis, they are shown to be superior to their husbands. Then we talk about Ashrama. With Varana, we talked about the example of Suta Goswami. With respect to race, we talked about Tritrasura. Then with respect to Ashrama, we talk about Durvasa Muni and Ambarish Maharaj. Then with respect to worldly position and wealth, we talked about Jadbharat and Rahuguna. And then we talked about, so this was the material hierarchy. Then we talked even about spiritual hierarchy. So how with the spiritual hierarchy? The impersonal conception is considered lower than the personal, that is through the example of Shukadeva Goswami and Kumaras. Then how? The Vishnu worship is not as high as Krishna worship. That's with respect to the Krishna Arjuna going to Mahavishnu. Then we discussed about how Madhurya Bhakti is higher than Vraja and Aishwarya Bhakti. That is Uddhava's. Basically the contention between the Mathura Dwarkavasis and Vrajavasis. And Uddhava comes at the vortex of them. And lastly we discussed about separation and union, and how separation can lead to a deeper sense of union. Thank you very much. Is there any one question or comment? So Granthra Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jai Gaur Premanande.